I think our attention is a bit like a river. So sometimes you could do with a dam because you can't stop yourself from focusing on something. And sometimes you go through massive droughts. But most attempts to forcefully redirect rivers or mess with their flow, yeah, they end badly in the long run. So I think we should actually honor the irregularities of the flow and go with it.
Hello and welcome to the Women and ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Katie Weber. I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 45, and it completely turned my world upside down. I've been looking back at so much of my life, school, jobs, my relationships, all of it with this new lens, and it has been nothing short of overwhelming. I quickly discovered I was not the only woman to have this experience, and now I interview other women who, like me, discovered in adulthood they have ADHD and are finally feeling like they understand who they are and how to best lean into their strengths, both professionally and personally. Today, I'm going to share with you two reviews from the Apple Podcast platform, both of which directly reference one of my favorite episodes, episode 82 with Casey Davis of Struggle Care. She's beyond brilliant, and we talk about so many common struggles and pain points. If you're a fan of this podcast and somehow you missed that episode, make sure to go listen to it. After you listen to this episode, of course. Okay, the first review is from Chubba123. It's entitled Mind Blown. Listening to your interview with Casey Davis, I feel like I have been hit with so much information in a good way, especially in the beginning. ADHD isn't about lack of attention, it is lack of ability to regulate your attention. I have had my suspicions for a while, but in my heart, I always knew something was just different about me. I hopefully am meeting with a new doctor soon to get on the road to diagnosis and learning more about myself. Thank you so much. And the next one is from a listener called Betsy McKeeman. It's entitled, OMG, This Isn't How Other People Operate. Longtime subscriber, first time reviewer. I'm listening to your interview with Casey Davis today in tears. I was struck so profoundly by your discussion with her around finally being able to acknowledge to yourselves how hard you had been working just to keep from forgetting things on a day-to-day basis. I was diagnosed at 36, and at nearly 42, this is something I still struggle with daily. But when Casey said, now I have to choose, am I going to go to the garage and get more toilet paper and forget what I was on my way to do? Or am I going to keep doing what I was doing and forget the toilet paper? And I will only remember it when I come across it in my visual field. The part that really sold me on having ADHD was realizing, oh my God, this isn't how other people operate. This isn't how other people operate. And I'm crying again. You are such a gift. Thank you so much for this. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm taking this phrasing back to my MD to let her know my meds need to be adjusted again. Thank you, Chubba and Betsy. Chubba, I hope you had a good experience with your new doctor and that you've been finding help and support on your diagnosis journey. Betsy, I'm sorry I keep making you cry, but thank you so much for taking the time out of your day for that lovely feedback and review. Big hugs to both of you out there if you're listening. Okay, here we are at episode 103, in which I interview Christine Syrad. Christine is a gastronomist and fermentation enthusiast who also happens to speak 5 languages. She grew up between the UK, Japan, and Italy and has spent the last decade or so in Switzerland, where she now resides with her husband and daughter. She's also the face of Fermentable, where she not only teaches workshops to other chefs about the art of fermentation, but also packages and sells her own fermented products. Christine and I talk all about her globetrotting childhood and mixed-race heritage, and how her ADHD contributed to her many varied career paths over the years, as well as how she believes her hypersensitivity helped her learn so many languages over the years. We also talk about her years living in Japan and how ADHD is viewed in Japanese culture. Christine is an absolute delight and a wonderful storyteller. I truly hope you love this interview as much as I did. Enjoy. All right. Well, Christine, thank you so much for joining me. I'm very excited to chat with you and hear a little bit more about your own crazy story. So why don't we just get started then? I'm curious. You had mentioned in our correspondence that you were diagnosed when I had a kid, which I think just says so much. You're just like the chaos of a child entering your life. But what was going on at that time? How old were you? And kind of what specifically was happening that made you start to look into ADHD or think, I need to look into this?
Yeah, so it's a little bit long-winded, I have to say.
It always is.
right, especially us. So this was last year. My daughter's 4.5, but it all came to a head last year when I was 34. And basically, I mean, her entrance into my life did disrupt things. But to be fair, so did COVID and the fact that I'd moved to a new place in Switzerland, quite a rural place. Was pregnant, you know, there were all these other things going on. And, you know, becoming a mother was definitely quite full on, but I think it would be remiss of me to say it was just simply motherhood. It was definitely the catalyst, but there's quite a big caveat. So my daughter was breech, which led to a few complications. She's perfectly healthy and fine. But she had hip dysplasia and she had a sixth toe, which has nothing to do with her having a breech, but it did require an extra operation. And most importantly, she had congenital torticollis, and it was actually really severe. Like, I later, as in last year, right before my diagnosis, found out that it was sort of, the severity is like 1 in 1,000 in terms of how often it occurs. But I was not privy to that information for 3.5 years. So basically, my struggling with trying to find a way to help her and feeling like I was failing, because all the physio we were doing, the osteopathy, the Feldenkrais, which, you know, was, it started when she was 2 weeks old, and we were going weekly, sometimes bi-weekly. And honestly, there was just no improvement. And I think I assume this is quite relatable, but when you've been living with ADHD and you have no idea, you've probably spent a lot of your life being told that you've sort of got the wrong end of the stick, you haven't interpreted instructions properly, all that auditory processing, not going the way everyone else expects it to go, and also just feeling like, generally feeling like you don't have the manual that everyone's been given, right, on life. So there I am, having been told by multiple medical professionals that all I needed to do was continue with the stretching and the physio and, you know, make her sleep in a certain position, et cetera, et cetera. And it would all, you know, clear itself up. And they're thinking, oh, I'm definitely doing something wrong because it's really not getting any better. And I think I'd already come to terms with the fact that it wasn't my fault that she had it in the first place. I did a lot of, self-talk, let's say. I kept telling myself actively that there was nothing I could have done about her being breech. But I was trying to push this voice to the back of my head that was telling me, yet, you know, since she was born, you haven't been doing enough, or you're unaware of something that you should know about. And, you know, then came COVID. I live in Switzerland, but my parents live in Japan. The rest of my family lives in the UK, so I didn't get to see them at all. My grandmother passed away during COVID, and I didn't get to see her. My work is in gastronomy, and I'm freelance, so that completely dried up for basically 2 years here. So this whole cocktail led me to the initial diagnosis of severe depression. And luckily, I had the just gut feeling that my doctor wasn't quite right for me. And I switched to an American lady here in Biel. I live in a relatively small town, but I have a wonderful American therapist who, after a couple of sessions, I think basically she very cleverly nudged me towards me asking, hang on a second, could I have ADHD? To which she said, well, if you didn't mention it, I was waiting for you to mention it today. And if you didn't, I was going to bring it up next week. I was like, oh. And, you know, thanks to her, well, just, you know, my world has changed. And I'm very fortunate to say that I'm off the antidepressants now, at least for now. And now that I've got to sort of the root cause of it, I'm doing a lot better. But it wasn't easy. This whole... you know, the feeling that everyone knows what's going on and you don't, it's just been going on for my whole life. So when it came to something as important as my daughter's health, it basically destroyed me. So obviously, becoming a mother in a foreign country as well is a lot. And all the coping mechanisms that you've unknowingly built around you tend to crumble. And that's what happened to me. And then you throw in COVID, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that my daughter had health issues. And voila, there you have it. ADHD diagnosis at age 34.
Wow. Oh, I want to give that mother a hug. It's so relatable in just in terms of the overwhelm of even just mm-hmm. thinking about like the sleep deprivation when you have a baby and the hormonal changes of your body. You know, your body is so foreign, and to imagine like just going back to the hospital over and over and over again. And then also just knowing, not even with illness of my children, but I remember when my mother was ill, you know, I was always keeping notes because every doctor was coming in and just peppering me with information. Yeah. And this was before my diagnosis as well, but like just always knowing that I was going to immediately forget everything they said and desperately trying to like cling to all of that information and feeling like somehow that might give me some sense of control in a totally uncontrollable situation. Oh my goodness. Well, I'm glad it led to a diagnosis because, you know, like you say, you're world changes so drastically.
What do you really, really, really?
Yeah. What do you, when you said my world has changed, I took note of, wrote that down in my notes. How did it change for you?
Oh, it's so manifold. I mean, first of all, I immediately recognized that. I'm the only one that's officially diagnosed in my entire family. It's quite clear to me as a non-professional, but someone who's lived with the condition for 35 years now, that my husband likely has it. Different symptoms, but even he's warmed to the idea now. And my father, and my grandfather, and my daughter, most likely. So first of all, it's taught me, to be mindful of that with my family members, you know. When they're acting in a less than agreeable way, I try to remind myself that, well, they are probably struggling with the same things that I struggle with. And they're not as equipped as I am now. So there's that. And then, well, my therapist put it really well, actually last week. So it's been almost a year since my diagnosis, but she pointed out that I'm still grieving my neurotypical sense of self. And I think that's really true. And I look back on like many of the people who have been on your show, we all look back on things from the past and we go, oh my gosh, if only I'd known. And so I'm so much more compassionate with myself. I'm still struggling with, but learning to calm down because I'm not good at that and to let myself off the hook when I've done something badly. But I guess most importantly, to not dwell on when I've done something badly and to shift the focus. I think I spent a lot of my time trying to improve on the things that I was bad at rather than further excelling at the things that came easily to me. And that was quite heartbreaking when I look back, because actually my academic career, my professional career up to a certain point, it's definitely dictated by this whole need to prove that my flaws, they won't bring me down, you know, but it meant I wasn't really maintaining the things I was good at and kind of ignoring them. So that's something I'm trying really hard now to sort of change. If I can't do something, you know, I weigh up whether it's worth, you know, well, taxes and things like that, you know, you've got to. But other things like, you know, I've let my friends all know that I just can't do punctuality. It's a miracle I'm here for this interview on time. So, you know, I've just told them, like, if you can't handle it, I'm really sorry. Then with friends who I'm not that close with, I've had to say, like, it's a huge source of stress for me if I have to try really hard to be on time. And if you can't handle it, then it's okay. I respect that. Don't worry. But I'm not going to fix it for your benefit. It's not like I'm an hour late to meetings. It's usually 5 or 10 minutes. But for some people, that's really annoying. So, and I understand that. So, you know, things like that where I've just said, well, I may lose a relationship over some of my habits that I'm not really willing to spend a lot of energy and time on improving. But, you know, the people that really love me and I love too aren't that bothered by it. So all these things basically have just made my life at least a smidgen easier.
I know, right? You have to kind of qualify that. Yeah, that's so well said. And I think, you know, there's something about the diagnosis, just giving that language to who we are, and is really the start of those boundaries that you talk about, right? And really setting ourselves up for, like, what am I comfortable with? What can I ask for too? I think that's the other thing. It sort of really opens up that understanding, and that language really opens up, like, what do I need to ask for right now in my life? Whereas, like, it feels so easy when you say it out loud. And yet I think about, you know, that one of those things that I struggled the most with, which was just like self-actualization and just self-realization and real, like, what do I even need? Just always pushing forward, pushing through, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Now, you have such an interesting, unique childhood. So I want to just backtrack here and kind of go through this timeline, because your father's British, your mother is native to Japan, but they met in the UK, or did they meet in Japan and then move to the UK?
Actually, they met in Japan in a pub, because my mother had gone to the UK to learn English. And she found that playing darts with old men was the best way to learn sort of authentic English. So she continued going down to the pub that was full of foreigners at the time in her hometown of Osaka. And just, she continued to play darts and drink pints of beer. And my dad was intrigued. He was there. He spent some time in Italy first after finishing his studies. And then he thought, oh, no, I need to go somewhere more exotic, or, you know, I need to feel a little more out of my depth. So he went to Japan and purposely chose to go to Osaka rather than Tokyo, where he knew there'd be fewer foreigners.
Plus, it's an amazing city. Having been to both, it is, yeah. It's so fantastic. I feel like I'm on a drug trip when I'm in Osaka.
That's a really good description of the experience. Yeah, definitely. So yeah, he chose to go there. He'd heard the people are funny, which, you know, I can attest to. And so they met, you know, in a pub, but in Japan. And when he decided he had to go back and get a real job back in the UK, he decided he couldn't live without her. So they had agreed that they weren't even going to bring up marriage. But, that happened. And then my mom was dragged back to the UK. Her time in the UK when she was 18 was miraculous, because, you know, it was not miraculous. It was more like, she really thoroughly enjoyed it because it was temporary. But when she went back, she realized the food choices were really difficult for her. So when I was 3, my dad said, okay, I'm going to try and placate my wife because I care about her. We're going to move to Italy, where, you know, there's at least more sunshine and the food is good. So they did that when I was 3. And I went to the local sort of kindergarten type thing there. And then when I was 6, my parents realized I'd actually missed the first year of school in the UK, because they start at 5 over there. They said, oh, okay, we should probably move back now. And we should probably send Christine back with her grandparents so she can start school. And then we'll make our way over later, which is quite significant, actually, because through therapy, I've realized that's one of the reasons I have a really hard time asking for help, because I was supposed to be quite independent age 6. And then that tangled with the ADHD has led to some interesting outcomes here and there in life. But yeah, we made it back to the UK and we were there until I was 10. And then my mum basically said, you know what, if we don't move to Japan now, it's going to be really difficult for Christine to catch up culturally and linguistically. So they did that basically for my sister and I's benefit. And they've lived there ever since. That was in 1997. And I came back to Europe when I was 18, because I chose to study English and Italian literature. Very useful, might I add.
And had you held on to Italian that whole time?
Yes. Well, I spoke children's Italian.
Okay.
Because my parents would, you know, they would ferry us back to the UK and to Italy every summer and I spent time with our family friends. But academically speaking, it was, my Italian was really lopsided, let's say. So that's also, well, basically, I didn't know what the heck to do. So I thought, well, I like Italian a lot, and English, you know, it's my best subject. So it didn't even occur to me to think of what I would do 4 years later. So I just went with what I liked, which is nice. You know, it's nice to be that naive, I suppose. Luckily, it has served me well in the long run, but I did finish my studies during the recession that hit in 2009. So that's when I thought, that's why people do things like economics and maths and engineering. But hey, it brought me to Switzerland because there were no jobs in London at the time.
And it was a banking job, was it not? Sort of. It was in the genre.
It became one, yes. Yeah, so I had done an internship at an investment bank while I was studying, and it was a Japanese investment bank. So basically, by virtue of speaking Japanese, they took me on. And I actually really liked it. I was really surprised because it was so varied day to day. You know, you had to keep up with current events, and that would impact, you know, had like a domino effect on multiple things. And I, you know, it's perfect for someone with ADHD. But they had to withdraw their offer of taking me on after graduation because they'd fired their entire second floor. At which point I was like, well, I'm not going to compete with all the other people who have studied the relevant subject for a handful of jobs. And out of the blue, I got sort of quasi headhunted for a position in marketing, actually, in Switzerland. And they wanted a Japanese speaker, but they also wanted an Italian speaker. And I was cheap. So they took me. I didn't even really know what marketing was. I'm not going to lie. I basically had no clue. But I was like, I need a job.
How hard could it be?
Exactly. It was the worst possible job for someone with ADHD. It was Google Ads. So basically I had to, every day I had to monitor how much each keyword had cost a campaign. So that's a lot of Excel files, a lot of looking at micro movements, no big bangs, nothing. And I did that for 2 years, moved into another team within the company, realized it's just not my thing. And I really wanted to improve my German. So I thought, let's try banking again. I'm in Switzerland, you know, why not? And I wormed my way into a job I was not at all qualified for. Ironically, I'd been rejected for all the appropriate jobs, like communications, etc. No reply there. But I ended up in private banking for Japanese clients. And little did I know I was going to like that even less than marketing. But it felt like an achievement to kind of weasel my way into a world that I really didn't belong in. I think a lot of people that I've met who have ADHD, we have the same kind of effect on people. We manage to convince people that, you know, we're fast learners. We'll get the job done. Don't worry. So that's how I got the job. But it didn't last long. 2 years later, I was out of there as soon as I got my residency permit.
I think about so many jobs I applied for where the qualifications I said I had, and then the night before, I would just be cramming, learning as much as I possibly could to fake it about that software.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
They file that under the signs were there all along.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, isn't it? Being quick on our feet. Until I get severely burnt by that, by the procrastination, the, you know, waiting till the last minute to prepare, or finding myself in a situation I don't belong, but thinking, I'll convince them. It hasn't burnt me yet. So I just know I'm going to continue to do it. But it's highly stressful.
Well, it was actually Tamara Rosier's book, Your Brain Is Not Broken, that really sort of shifted my mentality around procrastination. I kind of enjoy it now. I feel like I'm trying to reframe it and kind of enjoy the ride a little bit more. And I feel like a lot of the downside of procrastination tends to be the anxiety leading up to it. So I like try to minimize the anxiety leading up to the procrastination and just accept that there is no other way but to leave it to last minute in order to sort of create the sense of urgency. So that's what I'm trying to do about that. That it actually becomes a lot easier to just say, I'm going to do that last minute because that's how I do things and just accept it.
I like that a lot, actually. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's really helped me kind of feel to minimize some of the angst around the process.
I'd like to take a moment to thank BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know I am a big proponent of therapy. Therapy provides me the best opportunity for verbal processing, something that is so important for my kind of brain and my sense of self. What I love about BetterHelp is that it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional therapy that's done securely online from the comfort of your home. They assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and it's available for clients worldwide. So you get access to a broad range of expertise that might not be available to you locally. It also tends to be more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. If you visit their website and read their testimonials, there are actually quite a few reviews that specifically reference help with ADHD. As a special offer for listeners of the Women and ADHD podcast, you'll get 10% off your first month. Simply sign up at betterhelp.com/womenADHD. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/womenADHD. And there's a link in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.
So how many languages do you speak?
Well, I function in five. This is the thing. I was asked recently by a friend if I had any advice on how to improve their French, because French is the last language. I hesitate to use the word learnt because I don't do learning. I do picking up. I picked it up really quickly. It helps to speak Italian. They're pretty close. It helps that I'm married to a French man and that we moved to a region where half the people speak French. I live near the only bilingual city in Switzerland, so you get both thrown at you on a daily basis, German and French. And I didn't know how to answer her, basically. I'm a qualified English teacher. That's what I did while I was bored at the bank. I got myself a CELTA diploma from my desk.
Yeah. Why not?
Because I was that understimulated. So, you know, despite being a teacher and having worked as a teacher, I didn't actually have concrete advice. And I actually, now that I've been diagnosed, I think it's due to the hypersensitivity. I always thought I had problems with my ears because I'm always saying like, what? And seemingly not hearing things. But I can't drown things out is what I've realized is the case. If I can hear a clock ticking somewhere and the tap's running and someone's trying to talk to me, forget it. I just can't. My brain won't prioritize their voice over all the other distractions. And I think while it annoys the people around me sometimes because they have to repeat themselves or they have to turn down the music just to talk to me, I think it's actually put me in good stead in terms of picking up languages because I just hear the nuances, the little details, and they go straight into my brain, basically. And it may sound arrogant, but it's rather effortless. I mean, English and Japanese I grew up with. So they're part of my heritage. It was part of everyday life growing up. And then Italian was gifted to me, I'd say, by my parents. But with German and French, considering it's meant to be difficult to learn a language once you reach adulthood, it was relatively effortless. But you shouldn't look too closely at my grammar. You know, and I teach in French now. I get by in French, you know, pretty much. I feel quite at ease in French. But oh my gosh, I'm so grateful to translation software and stuff for when I have to actually write an email. Because if you want to sit me down and get me to actually review conjugation and stuff like that, then it's going to take a lot of sedating. So yeah. It's been an organic process. So there are massive holes, but you know, I can pass for someone who speaks the language and comprehend the language really well in five languages, you can say.
Wow. It's so fascinating about the that your theory about sort of the difficulty, what's the word, the hypersensitivity, but that sort of difficulty in terms of filtering information, exactly, and how that actually, you know, sort of allows everything to be absorbed. I love that idea because I've often talked on the podcast about memory and how there's certain things that I found interesting about, you know, I will have a really difficult time with so many, you know, with short-term memory and so many things, you know, somebody will introduce themselves, I'll immediately forget their name, that kind of thing. But like, I never had a hard time with monologues, you know, memorizing monologues or, you know, when I was in theater. And so, it would, you know, I was like, there's different parts of your brain where things just sit. And then when it's time to access it, it's like you said, it's effortless. It just tumbles out of you. And I feel like language almost just sort of falls into that, even though, I mean, I growing up in Canada, I spent probably at least 12 years learning French, and I've retained almost none of it. and that fascinates me too. You know, just grammar, vocabulary, just the memory and vocabulary is just impossible to me. I can conjugate, no problem, but I have no vocabulary anymore.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's context driven as well, isn't it? I think if you were really into the monologue, I can see how it would be easier. I mean, dopamine, right?
Yeah.
To retain than something that feels maybe inconsequential in that moment, you know. I think dopamine determines what I retain and what I don't retain, to be honest.
Now, do you require subtitles when you are watching TV or movies? Because I feel like that's another one that we sort of think a lot about, which is like, why the need for subtitles? Sometimes I think it's to anchor my attention to a movie or a TV show, but I also have a really difficult time hearing, you know, like I had a really, really hard time when we were all wearing masks. I could not hear a thing. I really didn't realize how much I relied on mouth movements and lip reading. And so I'm like, well, maybe subtitles has to do with that in terms of filtering it sound. So I'm curious, do you rely on subtititles and what language do you put them in?
I absolutely do. But the thing is, in Japan, there are subtitles on all TV shows. Not you know, like a TV series, but a talk show, for example, always has subtitles. And I wasn't sure why. Still not entirely sure why. But I think I definitely, you know, I come with this preconditioning. But, well, as I get older, I definitely rely on them more. And I think it's the same as you. I use it to anchor myself, actually. And I usually have the subtitles on in the same language. Actually, it's really, there's a language tip. If you watch a TV show in French, it's good to have the French subtitles there because actually, you know, they don't pronounce the words the way they're written half the time. So it's nice to have that cue. I found that depending on the sound system as well, I really need subtitles. If the bass or, I don't know, something other than the vocals come out strong, I have, again, I think it's the filtering thing. I can't focus on what's being said. But now that you mention it, I do think I need subtitles in order to stay focused on watching the show, because otherwise I'll get up and go and do something else. And I actually met someone around the time I got my diagnosis. He was getting his diagnosis too. And he's the only other person I've met who had to have, that I've met in person. I've heard about the phenomenon a lot since, but we had to have some sort of TV show on in the background in order to actually get our work done. So, you know, talk about academic work, but I always had something like Sex and the City or something that I'd already watched a few times on in the background. And we both realized, oh, that was our anchor. We needed something that we could just sort of listen to, I don't know, corner of your ear, making up idioms here, but you know, it was just on in the background, but you were paying just enough attention to it to not feel the need to go up and, I don't know, do the washing up or invent a new cocktail, you know? I realized I have two ways of consuming media. So if I don't have the subtitles on, it usually means I'm doing something at the same time. And it's just this comforting thing that I have that glues me to what I'm doing. And if I actually want to consume the show or whatever it is that I'm watching, I need the subtitles. Or my mind wanders, but more likely my body wanders. I'll just leave the room. So yeah, I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, now that you mention it, it's definitely, it has a lot to do with that too. Yeah.
Right? It is. I'm so fascinated by that. And you're right. It is. It's very common to have a show, you know, to sort of rewatch old shows over and over again and to have them in the background as almost like a form of body doubling, too, like just a form of company in the way that I might have used going to a coffee shop when I was studying the same way. And I'm like, is that just background noise or is there something about the company of other people? So yeah, it's so fascinating and also so validating when you hear other people who are also doing these weird things, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
And okay, so now I have some more questions. I feel like I feel giddy because they're such silly questions, but I'm like, what language do you dream in?
You know, that was a question for me in a job interview.
Really?
I had the weirdest interview at a bank in Zurich, and actually the guy was like, my daughter's never lived in Japan. He was Japanese. My daughter's never lived in Japan, and when she sleeps, she sleep talks in English, and I'm really concerned. What language do you dream in? I'm like, what does this have to do with the job? And I told him, I never remember, to be honest. I have no idea.
Wow.
I do sleep talk from time to time, apparently. And it's what I say and do is apparently terrifying. And that's usually been in the language of whoever I have to share the room with.
Well, that's really considerate.
Yes, except for when, you know, I'm saying, you know, my friend said once she woke up and I was crawling to the end of the bed and I was saying, she's coming, you know, horrible things like that. It might have been better if I'd said that in Japanese and she couldn't understand. But I don't know how to answer that one. I never remember the language.
But do you have like a default thinking language when you're by yourself, considering we have the constant monologues in our head?
It's definitely context-based, I'd say, because it tends to be English, because my husband and I speak English together, and most of the close friendships I have here are sort of English-based, let's say. So English is dominant now in my life. I'd say before, when I lived in Japan, it was Japanese. My friends and I spoke a complete mix of the two. But oddly, sometimes if I'm with my parents-in-law, I find myself thinking in French, even though I'm not that agile in French, which is probably why by 9 p.m. I'm exhausted. So I'm quite heavily influenced by my surroundings, I think.
Yeah.
But it's usually English, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah. So fascinating. My brother is a polyglot. And so it's always been one of those things where I'm like, I'm pretty sure he has ADHD, but I so deeply do not relate to multilingual, that talent, that I'm like, how is it possible? And yet there is a lot that feels, like you said, like that makes sense in terms of being, you know, juggling these plates, but metaphorically speaking. And then, do you feel like looking back at your, you know, over your life through this lens, as one does after an ADHD diagnosis, do you feel like, I guess, you know, two part, what were some of those things growing up? You had mentioned growing up with your grandparents and sort of needing to be self-sufficient at an early age. I think it definitely rings true. Are there other things that you notice where you're just sort of like, oh, the signs were so clearly there all along? I'll just ask that question because the other one's a little too obtuse.
No, there's no such thing. I have prepared for that question. Okay. I mean, there were just so many. I was actually talking to my mom. She was here. We celebrated her birthday all together here 2 weeks ago. So she was just here from Japan. And as she was leaving, I kind of told her that, you know, I appreciate everything she did for me, but it must have been hard not knowing that I had ADHD for her as well. Because I took so many risks. I would jump off of furniture sort of 2 meters high at least when I was 4, try and land on my bed, and I missed. And in Italy, we had this like really hard tiling, you know, and silly me, I did it in front of a friend. So he told my mom what I did. But the thing is, I'd get into trouble. And I think that was just like a default reaction. I don't blame her for it. I think when you're concerned for your child, you tend to sort of, it's outrage really, isn't it? That you see from the kid's point of view. And so I did things like, I couldn't really roller skate very well, but there was a wall about 20 centimeters wide and a meter high that I decided to rollerblade along. And I fell, obviously without helmet, on my head. And I was in so much pain that I hid under my parents' bed and was crying. And when I was asked what happened, I didn't dare say what it was. And when I look back on it, I'm like, oh my God, you know, I could have had, I probably did have concussion, but you know, I think children are just, they recover quickly. I think it was really quite bad. And, you know, had it been just a little worse, me not telling my parents could have had, you know, really detrimental effect. And so there are things like that where I think, okay, to me, it's obvious because I'm now equipped with way more information about all the symptoms and behaviors, you know? But to my parents, it wasn't. And those are just, you know, things in sort of early childhood. But if we fast forward to academic, you know, when my life became more academic, it just got so clear. Like, I did the International Baccalaureate, and I would not wish that upon any young adult with ADHD. Even my therapist has said, because she's an English speaking one, you know, working in Switzerland, a lot of her patients or, you know, clients, they, the ones that are going through the IB, are really suffering. And I think that's where I really would have liked to have known, actually, because until I turned 16, I was quite, well, I was definitely a people pleaser already at that point, having been told numerous times, you know, it's nice, this piece of work that you've done is nice, but it's not what we asked you to do. You know, I always got this like backhanded compliment. And then I really put a lot of pressure on myself to sort of get with the program, I suppose. And it was all going quite swimmingly until the IB. And the IB is 6 subjects that you have to do, 3 of which you're supposed to be very good at. Those are at a higher level. And 3 of which, you know, you have to do them, but they may not be your strongest subjects. It's to, you know, produce well-rounded students, of course. And then there's theory of knowledge, which is basically philosophy, and that required an essay and some sort of dissertation-like essay that was completely unrelated to any subject you're doing. And then creativity and action and service, 50 hours of each that you have to submit. It was a lot to, you know, stay on top of. And I decided to go to university in the UK. So I was actually required to get a certain score, overall score, in order to be accepted to the university, my first choice. And I was so jealous of my friends who were going to the US because they just had to do the SAT and get good grades, but they didn't have to get good marks in the things they were absolutely crap at. And I stayed awake till 4 a.m. doing my physics, like lab write-ups, because I just couldn't get them right. I had so many redos. Because as soon as everything became sort of really rigid, I struggled all over again. And on top of that, I was taking flute lessons, and my mother would give me, she would give me the money I was supposed to give to my flute teacher every month. And unless I was prompted, which I never was, I just forgot, because I was playing the flute, but also thinking about what books I had to get from my locker, you know, in the 10 minutes I have before my next class. And so I racked up about $800 equivalent worth in flute lesson fees that I never gave her. And so she called my mum, and my mum was mortified because I had the money and I'd been walking around with all this cash in my bag, just forgetting to give it to her. And so my mum said, can you just remind her, please? You know, she can be a bit scatty. And my teacher was just like, no, she needs to learn, you know. And, you know, the thing is, I agreed with her at the time. I thought, yeah, why can't I just remember? But out of sight, out of mind, I was already struggling with the academic side of things. I just needed her to say, hey, can you, you know, do you have the envelope? But she didn't want to. And so she didn't get the money for a long time. And so, you know, there are all these moments looking back where I thought, oh, gosh, if I'd known, I would have been kinder to myself. I'm sure people would have made accommodations for me. I might have even actually informed the university that I was applying to that I probably won't do as well as, you know, we all hope in things like maths and physics. That would have been in my letter. But yeah, they all feel a little bit like missed opportunities. But I look back and think, well, I made it though, despite all that. Mm-hmm. So there's like a bit of heartbreak for all the struggles that I went through. But also, I think it's just made me good with adversity, for better and for worse. Like I said, I have a hard time asking for help. And that's something I'm working on. And I think all of it sort of just combined has contributed to that. I probably thought, even if I ask for help, I might not understand the help that I'm being given.
Well, oftentimes I feel like it's hard to even articulate what help we need in the given moment. Yes, right?
Absolutely.
And that can be really difficult, which is like, I don't even know how to ask for help and what I would even ask for. So I'm just going to remain in this state of chronic overwhelm until
I implode.
Yeah. So now, what was your mother's reaction? Because I'm curious, how is ADHD viewed in Japanese culture? Was she just like, that's the English side of you?
Well, I do think she has it to a certain degree as well. And I think, you know, that's how she and my dad have managed to stay married for so long. Because, you know, my dad's brilliant. He's so clever. But oh my gosh, just the number of times he's lost credit cards and things, you know, started conversations with the people at the table next to us rather than continuing the conversation, you know, at a restaurant with his actual family, things like this, you know, that would drive most people mad. She seems to have a certain tolerance for it. So she was surprised, but not surprised actually. She then did some research and told me that in Japan, you're considered a diversity hire. It's like a quota in big companies. That companies have to adhere to. They have to have a certain number of ADHD hires. I had no idea actually, because it's just not talked about.
Yeah.
I find it's not talked about much in Europe in general, like on the continent either. It's definitely, I mean, it seems to be an Anglophone centric cluster of information that's available at the moment. But I know another Japanese lady here, and she got diagnosed in Japan. So I guess it's people are talking about it a little bit. But my mum was very accepting. She's now trying to help me with managing how I relate to my daughter. But I think for her, realizing that she's married to someone who's not diagnosed, but clearly has ADHD, that has been eye-opening for her. I think because she still spends pretty much every day with him, whereas I'm kind of, you know, out of sight, out of mind for the most part, to be honest, because I'm on the other side of the world. But it's changed our relationship for the better. Not that we had a bad relationship, but I think I was able to tell her some of the frustrations I felt when I was a teenager. And we just sort of said, you know, it's a bit of a shame we didn't know, because we would have handled them better. But it's nobody's fault.
Yeah, I often feel like my mother is the person I want to most talk to about this, because I think she and I both struggled hand in hand when I was growing up. You know, she had just as much confusion about why I was the way I was. Or, you know, I think, and also, like you said, like I made so many poor choices. You know, they poor, maybe not. I don't know. They are what they are. But I was very impulsive. And I, you know, I dropped out of high school, I dropped out of university, you know, and so she saw me kind of always struggling or just lost. And I think she didn't know how to help me. And so I often felt like she would have been very relieved. You know, I don't think she would have, you know, sometimes I talk to women whose parents are very defensive, as though it's an attack on their parenting. And I think she would have been really relieved to like hear that. Oh, that's the, okay, now we have the answer finally. Because I think she, you know, it was painful for her to watch me struggle.
Absolutely. That's,
But it must be nice for your mom, like you said, like to sort of see the why behind some of these chronic behaviors too. I think that's also so helpful. And I loved what you said earlier just about how gracious you are with your family. I wish I need to adopt some of that with some of my undiagnosed family members with my armchair diagnoses too, of sort of having a little more compassion towards some of their behaviors to realize it's one thing to have ADHD. It's another thing entirely to have undiagnosed ADHD at the age of 80, right? You know, and to have been a completely different generation, that sort of thing. So I will take a page from your compassionate book.
I try. I'm not perfect. That no one is, but like there are moments where I do want to just say to my dad, your life would just be so much easier if you went and talked about it. But, you know, he's very busy. He's very excitable and he loves people. So he'll take on projects when he doesn't have the capacity and he manages it, you know. But I don't think he'd ever find the time to go and find out more. Not for his benefit, you know. Maybe he'd do it for his kids. But
right. That's a very ADHD thing too. My ADHD gets in the way of me getting lots of different diagnoses.
Oh, absolutely.
I should really go see a doctor about that. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Better to bury your head in the sand. Yep.
When I was diagnosed with ADHD, it completely turned my world upside down. I looked back at so much of my life, my grades in school, my multiple careers and hobbies, my friendships, my marriage, motherhood, my relationship with food and my body, like all of this with a new lens, and it was overwhelming to say the least. If you've been diagnosed with ADHD and you're feeling blown away by this new insight into your brain and how it operates, I totally understand. I can help you begin to sort through this chaos, explore who you are and how your brain operates, so you can finally start to lean into your strengths and begin to use them to your advantage moving forward. Together, we can work to identify what obstacles you've been facing and create strategies to help you start living a more fulfilling, gratifying life. Head over to womeninadhd.com/coaching to book a 30-minute initial consult with me so we can figure out if my brand of one-on-one coaching is right for you. Again, that's womeninadhd.com/coaching, and you can find that link in the episode show notes. Hey friend, if there's one thing I've learned about ADHD over the last few years is that we can thrive with the right combination of accountability, planning, coaching, and peer support. Knowing all this, I set out to create the ultimate all-in-one coaching and accountability community for adults with ADHD or learning disabilities. I knew I couldn't do it alone, so I joined forces with one of my favorite ADHD coaches, Alex Gilbert of Capable Consulting, and together we launched the ADHD Lounge. The Lounge was created as a safe place for neurodivergent adults away from other social media, where we offer live group calls, co-working, and body doubling every weekday for accountability, focus, and skill development. We have weekly and monthly goal planning sessions to keep yourself on track. We also have one-on-one office hours with myself and Alex. And of course, friendship and lots of peer support. We have 3 different membership levels to meet you where you're at. So if you're looking for an affordable way to stay connected, productive, and accountable, while also having regular access to ADHD coaching and expertise, then make sure to come join me in the ADHDlounge.com. Again, that's the ADHDlounge.com. And as a listener of the Women in ADHD podcast, you can get 30% off your first month with the code PODCAST30. So head to the ADHDlounge.com and use the code PODCAST30 to get 30% off your first month. During the early days of my diagnosis, as I was deep into hyper-focus ADHD research mode, I kept searching for some kind of all-in-one, everything you ever needed to know about ADHD in women handbook that I could reference and keep at my fingertips, but I never really found anything that suited me. That's why I've taken everything I've learned about ADHD in women and adults who are socialized as girls, and I've gathered it into a concise, easy-to-access, self-guided, and self-paced course so you can feel like you've got everything you need at your fingertips. It's called Hey, It's ADHD, and it has everything you need to start loving your brain and living a more fulfilling, gratifying life. I built this course to be helpful wherever you are on your ADHD journey. I am so excited to finally be able to offer this course, and I truly hope this will help you develop a deeper understanding of your ADHD brain and how to embrace it as you build yourself a toolkit for your own life. So head over to womeninadhd.com and click on the Hey, It's ADHD course tab for more information and to get started. So we haven't even talked about fermentation because I feel like that was interesting too in terms of just getting into that and just being such a, you know, chronic entrepreneur, but you've such, such a fascinating story. Okay. Before we talk about fermentation, I want to ask you if you would, did you have another name for ADHD, if you could call it something else?
I do. So I thought about this one quite long and hard, because I think, like most people who have been diagnosed, I don't like the name at all. I think it's a complete misnomer, and it's also very negative. So I think our attention is a bit like a river. So sometimes you could do with a dam because you can't stop yourself from focusing on something. And sometimes you go through massive droughts. But most attempts to forcefully redirect rivers or mess with their flow, yeah, they end badly in the long run. So I think we should actually honor the irregularities of the flow and go with it. And I think, you know, the name should reflect this. So, and I feel also this like concept applies to our energy and motivation as well, not just our attention. Like I said, my issue with the current name is it draws too much attention to hyperactivity and a deficit of attention, implying there's always too much or too little of one or the other. And it's just, it's so much more multifaceted than that. But if you have to boil it down to, for lack of a better word, a culprit, it's dopamine to me. So basically, it's not very catchy, but I call it dopamine driven. It's a bit of a tongue twister. Dopamine driven focus and attention. No, not focus and attention. Focus and action. Dopamine driven focus and action. Because I think you know, if there's dopamine to be found in something, I can focus for hours. Same with, you know, I love running, and I wasn't athletic. I wasn't very fit at all at school, but I derive, yeah, I guess a lot of dopamine from going out into the forest, you know, being alone and processing my thoughts. And I don't from other sports. People have tried to get me into other sports that are more sociable, and it just doesn't work. I love climbing as well. I basically like all these sports where you have to sort of lose yourself. It's my form of meditation, and I like them because they feel good. I'm at a lot more peace with my choices when I sort of put it down to dopamine seeking. I realize I can't force myself to want to do something. I can't force myself to like something. If it's not happening, it's not happening, you know? That's why I like what you said about procrastination, actually. I think I am going to try and embrace it more, because you got to wait till the moment. If you try to do it earlier and there's no fire under your ass, you know, then there's going to be no dopamine.
Right. Or even just, you know, how can I inject some dopamine into an otherwise uninteresting situation, like gamifying something? Or, you know, the example I always use is when people clean their kitchen and they'll make a TikTok video and on, you know, time lapse to clean their kitchen. And then they post it as though you want to watch this. And I find that fascinating, because I'm like, I'm not interested in you watching you clean your kitchen, although I'm sure some people are. But like, good for you for figuring out a very complicated way to get yourself to clean your kitchen, right? Which is like, the task of cleaning my kitchen is boring. But if I set up my tripod and turn it into a video and post it and add music and all of that stuff, then it'll get me to do this. And I'm like, well, all right, good for you. You figured out how to inject some dopamine into there. And I also think, too, the idea of chasing the dopamine was very fascinating to me when I was reading ADHD 2.0, and Halliwell and Rady were talking about the DMN, the default mode network, and how we sort of tend to catastrophize. We tend to focus on the negative when it is more interesting, and how much that lends to our self-concept, sort of like you were saying earlier about like, how much time we spend focusing on the things we're not able to do, as opposed and just dismissing all of the wonderful things that we do because they're effortless, and how that, you know, so clearly lends to our negative self-concept in adulthood. And I was like, I just remember just being blown away by like, yes, that is also seeking the dopamine. And how I, you know, all of that fretting and anxiety, or just, you know, the anxiety around procrastination, right? All of that time spent worrying, that is dopamine, you know, infused. So yeah, very fascinating.
I mean, I can now very nicely link what you've just said to my fermentation by talking about my day, actually.
Perfect.
So I'm at home now, but I was in my atelier earlier, and I have 35 kilos of jalapenos to process. And I'm turning them into this lemon jalapeno paste, a bit like a Japanese condiment that's yuzu-based, but I happen to have access to spent lemons. So a lady I work next to, she does juice, and I get to take the spent lemon and take off the zest and save that for, you know, until, well, now, basically. A local farmer grew these jalapenos for me, and I'm there. I get to the atelier, and I know I should get started because I've got to be home at 3, you know? But I notice I have a bill that's, you know, appeared in my inbox, and I was like, oh, I'm going to forget about that, so I better pay that bill of 3 francs 50, which is like $3. I was like, well, you know, this is clearly more important than getting started on this massive task. And I just did, I don't know, I spent an hour doing stuff like that, you know, peeling. I bought a new soda stream, because I don't know if you have those over there, but this thing that makes, you know, fizzy water. And I was like, oh, I should take off the ugly stickers that are on it. I'm like, and I, the whole time I was saying to myself, just get on with it, you know? And then, of course, I get into it, and then I'm really into it. And yeah, I have another 15 kilos of jalapenos that I need to go back and brine, you know? And I was just like, if I had been if I had sat down and faced my ADHD for a moment and said, you know what, you're going to want to do all these like irrelevant things first, but you're going to have to really be strict and just get on with the task at hand, or you're going to have to go back later in the evening and finish what you didn't do. I didn't give myself that moment. And it's fine, you know. Luckily, I like my job, so going back, it's 10-minute drive, it's nothing. Going back there and finishing up is no problem. But, you know, the alternative would have been finish up with this interview, relax a little bit before my daughter gets home. But, you know, it never pans out that way. And being self-employed and, like, in, you know, the food business where you plan your own time, it's time sensitive in terms of, you know, you got to work with the ingredients while they're fresh. Oh my gosh, it's great for dopamine, but it's also equally terrifying sometimes, because you've got to be really organized. So on one hand, I can't work for anyone. I clearly don't belong in an office. I can't do, you know, the 9 to 5. I'm made for entrepreneurship, but my gosh, like, you know, I'm my boss, and sometimes I don't like my boss.
I know. Yeah. I feel like whenever I talk to clients or any women who are complaining about their boss and administration, and I feel for them, because I struggled so much, and I highly doubt I could ever work for somebody again. Listening to them talk about administrative bullshit and just being like, and then them saying like, maybe I should go into business for myself. And I'm always like, no, that's not the answer.
Oh, it's so painful, isn't it, to hear those thoughts being said out loud. You're like, oh God, I have to bite my tongue so hard. Yeah.
Because yeah, I'm like, you're just going to trade all of that stuff for a whole other load of trouble. But yeah. So tell me a little bit more about Fermentable, and you work with chefs, or what are you doing right now?
Well, I had to create my own job essentially 8 years ago. I decided banking and sitting in an office basically wasn't for me. I can't handle arbitrary orders or tasks. I was always mouthy. I think I pissed off every manager I had. But in my defense, in the last job, I was like, I need more work. Can you give me more work, please? I'm not asking for a raise. I will die if I don't have any work. And they were just like, well, you know, you haven't been here very long, etc. And it was soul crushing. So I knew I wanted to work with food. I love food. I love that it brings people together. I knew I don't want to be a chef because I have so many other interests and it's just so full on. So I saved up some money. I did this English teaching qualification. And I was like, okay, I'm going to quit. And then I'm going to teach English and try and build up something to do with food. And at the time, I was getting ill a lot. I basically had mono that kept coming back. It's not supposed to, but I think I was really unhappy in my job. And so my immune system was not cooperating. So I was looking into fermented foods because I had a lot of it. You know, I had a lot of miso, fermented veggies, etc. back in Japan. And that's something that I definitely wasn't keeping up with. I didn't know I needed to when I came to Europe. So I just slowly started cooking with more fermented foods, And then I thought, well, actually, there are a lot of chemicals and preservatives in the things that I'm buying or importing back, you know, bringing back with me from Japan. That can't be good. So I decided I'm going to try and make things myself. I'm very passionate about organic food, whether it's labeled organic or just incidentally organic, you know. Yeah, all things food related when it comes to sustainability, seasonality, fairness, that kind of thing has been important to me since I did my year abroad in Italy. I was in Turin, which is the birthplace of slow food. And their motto is, you know, clean, good and fair. So I think a seed was planted then, and I decided I need to work with this concept somehow, but I don't want to go to culinary school and I don't want to be a chef. So I did work in a restaurant for 6 months just to, you know, brush up on life skills and things like this. And then I thought, you know what, fermentation is pretty cool. And at the time, it's exploded, but at the time, no one was talking about it. So I just decided to start giving workshops. You know, I mean, I was learning at the same time, to be honest, but to motivate myself to keep learning, I had to, terrify myself.
a workshop is such a great excuse to learn what you need to know for the workshop. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. You know, I mean, again, the signs are always there. And so that's how I've ended up giving workshops. I now work in a restaurant once a week, which suits me really well because I get the camaraderie. I have like colleagues and I do like restaurant work. Once a week is the dream, seeing as I have a family. And I'm now pivoting towards giving workshops to chefs for the most part. As much as I like teaching the layman, there are now plenty of other people doing fermentation workshops. And I think I've got to a point now I finally shed the imposter syndrome and I realized, thanks to all my cultural input, you know, basically throughout my life, I have quite a unique take on it. So I try to help chefs because I know they'll use it as well. I derive a lot of satisfaction knowing that what I teach them is going to have a ripple effect and it'll help them reduce waste in the kitchen. It'll help them stay seasonal. So I've moved towards focusing on teaching chefs. I still teach private events. I host private events in my atelier. And somehow I've ended up producing and selling products, which was never on my radar because it sounded like a lot of admin. And it is, to be honest. But, you know, they'd come to my classes and then ask, yeah, but I just want to buy what you've made, actually. And I'm a sucker for a compliment, I guess, you know. I'll be very modest about it. I'll be like, oh, no, you know, anyone can do that. But I like to be patted on the back, I suppose. So I was like, all right, then I'll make it so you can buy it. So it's just, you know, I have this very ADHD-friendly mishmash thing going on where no day is the same as another. Actually, that's what's good about fermentation as well, because you're not always in control. It's the microbes, it's the seasons, it's what's available. So you think you're in charge, but you're not. So the outcome is always fun because you're like, oh, that didn't go as I wanted to, but how can I pivot, you know? So it has a lot of leeway as well, so it suits me really well. And I've just kind of created this non-job in a way for myself in gastronomy.
I love that. And what a wonderful ADHD perspective to have on kind of how, you know, what mishmash that our lives are. And I, you know, I feel like I can finally have gratitude for all of the unfinished projects and different career paths and certifications and all of the random kind of way in which we learn in this chaotic patchwork quilt kind of way that leads me to sort of have this, you know, we just have interesting perspectives on, you know, bring your marketing background and mm-hmm. probably some of the banking industry background and all of this, right? Yeah.
True. Yeah. Oh, thank you. It's been eye-opening for me too. And thank you for what you've been doing. I mean, your podcast really helped me, especially at the beginning. Now I have so many podcasts lined up. So it's always, you know, but I keep coming back to your podcast. I keep coming back and, you know, when I'm having a moment of doubt, it lifts me up. I just want to, can I add one last thing? Because I think it will help mothers. One thing that I just, you know, when I think about what led to the depression and the diagnosis, Had my doctor, my daughter's doctor told me at the very beginning, there is no way that you can fix this. It has to be surgery or nothing. I wouldn't have been diagnosed probably. So, you know, that would have been far from ideal. But I would have also probably just been, you know, I would have saved a lot of anguish for 3.5 years. And so I think that's something I've learned now. When I go and talk to a medical professional, I actually tell them, look, I have ADHD. I need help with sort of grasping the severity of the situation. I need, otherwise my mind will just run in 3,000 different directions. And at the end of the day, I'll blame myself. And it's just something that we are so used to doing that, you know, it can easily be avoided. You know, all that self-loathing could have been avoided. So whether it be in a medical context or any other context, I do feel like sometimes if you're able to and you feel comfortable, it's good to just be upfront and say, look, you need to spell it out for me. You know, that would have changed a lot for me over the last 4 years. And it's something I'm quite passionate about, you know, getting people to speak up.
Exactly. Right. And I think advocacy around ADHD is something that a lot of us gravitate towards for that same reason, which is like, you know, a way to normalize it and to normalize the expression and develop the language that we were talking about of how to explain in a situation like that what your needs are. But also, you know, that feeling of like, if I can help one new mother get through that time, or, you know, a parent exactly. struggling with a child, or like all of those moments, if I could just like, I just want to hug them all. I just, you know, because of that feeling of like, oh, if only I had known. Yeah. So very well said. Well, thank you, Christine. Definitely. And so I will have in the show notes a link to Fermentable, but is there any other way people can reach out to you? And
I'm very slow on Instagram, but I am there at Fermentable. But yeah, I mean, if anyone's curious, just, you know, I love connecting people. They can just drop me a message in my website. And if they have any questions about fermentation or anything else I've said on the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous website.
Oh, thank you. My husband.
Beautiful website in all three languages. So it's wonderful.
Yes, don't look into the grammar of the other two languages too.
Oh, wonderful. All right, well, thank you again.
Thank you. And enjoy your day.
And there you have it. Thank you for listening, and I really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Women and ADHD podcast. Also, you know we ADHDers crave feedback, and I would really appreciate hearing from you, the listener. If you're a fan of the podcast, please take a moment to leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or Audible. And if that feels like too much, and I get it, then just take a few seconds right now to give me a 5-star rating. Or share this episode on your own social media to help reach more women who maybe have yet to discover and lean into this gift of neurodivergency. And they may still be struggling and don't even know why. And if you'd like to find out more about me and my one-on-one coaching for women with ADHD, head over to womenandadhd.com/coaching. And you can always find that link in the show notes. I'll see you next week when I interview another amazing woman who discovered that she is not lazy or crazy or broken, but she has ADHD, and she is now on the path to understanding her neurodiversity and finally using this gift to her advantage. Take care till then.